Hi everyone, we're from the SASK Collective, and before we begin, I wanted to acknowledge that the SASK and UBC is located on the unceded, traditional, ancestral, and occupied and unceded lands of the Halkomelem-speaking Musqueam people. What's important that we keep in mind is that when we are discussing topics that pertain to International Women's Day and topics like sexualized violence, that we know that sexualized violence is a tool used in colonialism against indigenous folks, and how the fact that we're on unceded lands means that these lands were taken without consent and cultures were stripped without consent, and that indigenous women, two-spirit folks, and trans indigenous individuals face much higher rates and statistics of sexualized violence than do their counterparts.
This is the SASK Collective for International Women's Day. We are teaming up with CITR to create some wonderful IWD content, and we have some volunteers and work employees at SASK. I wanted to give everyone the opportunity to introduce themselves if they feel comfortable. I have a little check-in, just your name, your pronoun, and my check-in question, which is up for debate. We can not do it if you don't want to, but if you could share a meal with any person in the world right now, who would it be?
A meal.
A meal.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, just very cute.
Oh my gosh. I'll start.
Okay, go off.
So my name is Nav, and I go by the pronoun she and hers. I'm a support worker at SASK. I recently graduated from SFU with my major in anthropology and social justice. So I'm all about International Women's Day, feminism, intersectionality. And it's great to be in a room full of people from different backgrounds. I were to have dinner with anyone right now, or lunch, or any food, probably Oprah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I've always wanted to meet her, and I feel like we both have the same taste palette, because she would always bring food to her show, and I'd be like, oh my god, that looks good.
So. I'm Lily, and I'm a volunteer at the SASK. I use she, her pronouns, and I think if I were this is going to be really typical, but I'm going to say Michelle Obama,
yeah.
because she seems like a great lady, and I want to eat food with her.
Mm-hmm.
My name is Alexa. I use she, her pronouns. If I had to choose someone to eat dinner with, it would probably be Beyonce, because Beyonce.
Yeah, you don't need an explanation for that.
Just Beyonce.
My name is Miley, she, her pronouns. I'm a volunteer at SASK. If I could have a meal with anybody, it would be, I really want to have a meal with Lady Gaga, just because I'm so invested in her friendship, quote unquote, with Bradley Cooper. I just want a tea. That's all. It's only self-interest for that meal.
I'm Nikki. I'm an outreach worker at the SASK, and I also use she, her pronouns. If I were to have dinner with, this is like a little bit less celebrity, but I would have a meal with Manal Mitani, who is a professor here at UBC.
Listening to this.
And could be listening to this. It's interesting because she used to host a radio show that I really loved. She's a mixed race Iranian and Indian woman, and she's like super great, and I like love her work and her involvement, and I just like just want to be her. I think like my life goals is to like be her. And I've met her before, and all three times I've met her I've had a like just a minor freak out, and I think she thinks I'm really weird, so I really hope she's not listening to this so she doesn't think I'm extra weird.
Okay, so my name is Tintin. I'm an outreach worker at the SASK, and I also use she, her pronouns. I could share a meal with any person in the world. I had two answers, actually. So the first one I thought of for some reason was Kacey Musgraves.
Oh my god.
Yes. Like, why not? I need to know what, you know,
what's
Grammy
up?
Winner. I said it.
You heard it here first.
Heard it here first.
It was announced here.
But then I was also thinking I'd like to eat a meal with Jenna Wortham. She's a podcast host from Still Processing.
Yes.
She's half of Still Processing, and I was listening to their podcast this morning, and I was like, oh, she's got, like, great takes, and she always does, but they were talking about Green Book, and I was like,
oh, yeah.
Aghast.
I haven't seen it.
Oh, it
won. Me neither.
I know. Yeah. I know. I won Best Picture, I know.
Yeah, and everyone was, like, freaking out.
Yeah.
It's, anyway, so thank you, everybody, for checking in with me. So today, we kind of had a meeting before this to talk about things that we might be interested in talking about in preparation for this recording. And it looked like we were going to focus our conversation on representations of relationships and femininity based on what we saw. And we will also be chatting about self-care and current cultures at UBC. So I kind of wanted to throw a question out to everybody. But how do we think that representations of women, women of color, and relationships have evolved and shifted throughout your lifetime?
So throughout my lifetime, it's interesting because I didn't grow up here for my like primary childhood years. So like women of color were the only things, or like Iranian women were the only things I ever saw, except that like Western, like Hollywood specifically has such a, it's so hegemonic that it's like global that I, even in the country that I was growing up in, you know, like Hollywood movies were so such a thing that we watched all the time. So then it was like non-existent, or if there were, they were very tokenized. And now, as quote unquote, like being woke, it gives you social capital and it's like trendy and profitable now. Women of color, like racialized voices are more centered, as we saw, for example, in the Oscars with the various movies that were nominated. But I guess that we saw, when we see something like Green Book winning, we see how surface level it is and how still it caters to the white gaze. And still I feel as though those, like our voices are just like profit makers. Mm-hmm. And it's only because it's just trendy now. And so it feels very disingenuous. So it's like another form of violence. But yeah, that's my take.
That's super true. It's like capitalism is so malleable that it just absorbs whatever is trendy. And right now it seems like racialized folk, marginalized folks are what's trendy, and that's being played out in like tokenism, whether that's like helpful to see representation, but at the end of the day it's like how meaningful is that representation really.
I was just wondering, like, what was your guys' first experience of seeing like relationships or femininity like in media as like a child?
Oh, good question.
I feel like for me it was probably like Disney movies.
Oh yeah.
But that's kind of a typical.
I remember growing up, I didn't want to be brown. And I hated showing up to school, as sad as it sounds, and having brown skin and dark hair and having to shave my legs because everyone else didn't have to, and not wanting to play volleyball because if I didn't want my armpit hair showing. And now I don't care. Like, I'm embracing my identity. And maybe part of that is because of the capitalist beliefs or that it's okay to be a woman of color and people are talking about it. But there's also a lot has not changed. And I saw this working in a predominantly white neighborhood in a cafe. And I would still get white men coming up to me and saying that I'm exotic or, you know, are you really from Punjab? Because that's not where the beautiful women live. Like, someone actually said that to me. And so there are, you know, I do have reminders of being othered and being somebody who doesn't belong to the predominant, like, white culture, for example. But I also feel empowered sitting in a room full of different identities and, you know, being able to talk and be heard in a way that I couldn't do when I was growing up. So,
going back to Lily's question as well, like, I think that what was my first representation of, like, femininity was probably Disney as well, but I feel like the most formative ones are when I was, like, an adolescent, like, when I was, like, 12 and, like, 13, and, like, understanding, like, okay, like, I understand gender. Like, I understand this is a thing that I am. But I remember just, like, watching a lot of rom-coms when I was, like, in middle school and stuff, and, like, that was mostly my introduction to being, like, not even just, like, a woman, but, like, a human being that's able to, like, form relationships. It's like, whoa, like, this is how it works. And I think a lot about, like, 500 Days of Summer. I know we talk about it in our workshops a lot, but it was, like, my favorite movie when I was 13 or, like, 14 or something. I really liked Zooey Deschanel. I, like, dressed like her. It was
like
so bad.
I also like New Girl, too. I'm, like, trying to think, because when I, because I moved here, my family immigrated here from Malaysia, like, 10, 11 years ago. So growing up in Malaysia, we, like, watched a lot of, like, Western TV shows and movies, and I would always get kind of, like, comments about how, like, I have an American accent, and even when I moved here, I didn't have much of, like, an accent that was different from my peers. So I feel like I grew up being conditioned to think that whiteness was the ideal, like, beauty standard, whether as, like, a woman or just, like, as a person. Like, whiteness was, like, very tied to value. And I think, even though we get more representation now, we have like Crazy Rich Asians and like To All the Boys I Loved Before, there's still that expectation and standard that like whiteness is still something that you're supposed to achieve, whether it's like you as a person or just like your partners and relationships. I found that like that for me, navigating gender and femininity in relation to whiteness as a woman of color is has been like very challenging. Like unlearning that internalized racism, especially when you're like growing up with these ideals.
Totally. And you get praised for like performing whiteness like in so many ways that are like maybe not even like directly being like, you're so like great for being white. It's like it's more like these like slight advantages that you get, and like who wants to turn that stuff, like who would want to turn that down, especially like as a young person, you're not really critical of it.
Going back to the relationship question, I think this is really interesting because, like, you have such a good point, Tintin, of, like, seeing these relationships play out. But for me, like, to this day, I haven't seen Iranian people be intimate in any media landscape. And I, like, literally challenge you to all think of the last time you saw two Middle Eastern people or two brown people, not to homogenize brown people, like, actually have intimacy on screen. And so one of my favorite writers and like performance artists, their name is Alok, and they're like a non-binary queer Indian like I said, poet, performance artist, and they have a piece, it's on like the ways in which for people of color seeing romance play out is such an act of voyeurism, because it's something that's not like granted to you, but you're forced to see it so often, and you're just like a voyeur in this thing that you're supposed to desire, but it's never really even given to you, because even if you are entering relationships, there's so much that comes with being a racialized woman dating, and especially if you're queer too, these different expectations that go into it, both from your significant other who could be like white or racialized, and both like in your family too, and the, all the stuff that goes into that too. So it's like such a good piece, and I was like, I super related, because I was like, yeah, like I saw 500 Days of Summer and I was like, so cute, so romantic, love Zooey Deschanel, but that's not relatable to me, like I don't get to enter a relationship like that, or Rachel McAdams and The Notebook, or all these like canonical like romance stories that we all see, even queer stories that are like still very white too.
That's a really interesting point that you bring up, like the queer aspect of that, because I was thinking weirdly about I watched a movie called The Handmaiden a few weeks ago,
I've heard of it.
Which is like it's a Korean movie, and it features a lesbian couple, and like I don't know, but it's directed by the guy who did Old Boy, so it's like a male director who like directs these two like lesbian, like a straight man who's Korean, but is directing these like two Korean women being intimate with each other, having romantic feelings for each other. But it's really weird because like even in that sense, like it's really like occupied by like the male gaze. Like for example, there's a 12-minute sex scene, or like not 12, it's like probably like 8 or so. It's really long. But it's like catered and geared towards men, I feel like. It's just, it's really weird. I don't know how to like parse that out, because like women and like queer women get such little representation on screen, but it's just weird to like see intimacy but through the eyes of like a straight guy.
And you almost have to be like, yay, we got this, but it's like, but if it has to always, you kind of have to like accept the bare minimum when it comes to like minority representation. You have to be like, even the fact that you can like list off like Crazy Rich Asians and To All the Boys We Loved Before is like not a good sign.
So the next question is kind of related to what you said actually, Nikki, but who are some individuals that you think are producing or creating valuable content and creating better forms of representation, and how are they doing it, in your opinion?
Manam Otani, I'm going to give her another shout out. She's a really good show. And I only use her just because she's, like, an accessible person, you know what I mean? Like, because there's so many celebrities who are, like, just, like, I'm never going to meet someone like Beyonce or Oprah. But these people are, like, someone in the community that, like, are still successful and, like, have found their voice, but they're not so distant and far away that I can only ever dream of them. But, yeah, so that's kind of cool. You should check out. I think she used to work for the CBC, and then she, like, ran a radio show here. And she's also a professor, so she's, like, a jack of all trades. Manel of all trades, if you will.
I feel like there's a lot of really positive people on YouTube right now.
Oh, yeah, go on.
Yeah.
Give us your hot takes.
Okay, the two that come to mind immediately are, like, Hannah Witten. Yeah, so she talks a lot about like sex mostly, and specifically with like disability and that sort of thing. And then, so she's really great. She's British. And then there's Shannon Boodram, I think is her name, and she talks a lot about relationships and, like, healthy relationships and sex as well, and, like, stigma around, like, STDs and that kind of thing. So, yeah, they're both more, like, positive relationship people. Yeah.
Okay.
That's amazing.
Side note, did y'all know that Kimberly Crenshaw has a podcast?
What?
Yeah, it's called Intersectionality Matters, which makes sense. But it's like, it's not on Spotify. On Spotify, it's like someone else, but it's on SoundCloud and other like streaming things. But yeah. I just found that out like a couple days ago.
That's amazing.
So, yeah, like, plug, that that is one.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was just like,
the OG.
The OG, yeah.
True. I've been listening to a lot of podcasts too.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is called No Man's Land. Mm-hmm. And I really like that one because it talks about women in history that have been forgotten.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting.
So that, you know, it's always interesting to listen to, especially because I one day want to be a social studies teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great thing to hear about, like, women that we've never, like, ordinary women in history that have always been there against all these, like, famous historical figures, and yet we don't know who they are, which is really scary. I'm listening to one called What Is Love? It talks about unconventional love stories.
Mm-hmm.
And when we think of love, we always think that, oh, we have to be in love with a partner or a person. But it goes beyond that.
Mm-hmm. Been listening to King Princess a lot.
Yeah.
As always.
Oh, I've been, like, so into Janelle Monáe. Underrated. Should have won. Hot take.
Not a hot take.
You heard it here first. Yeah. There's, like, a really good podcast called The Secret Life of Canada. Like,
oh, I love that.
It's really, really good. I think I stopped listening to it because they're off Spotify, but I think they're on, like, other platforms now. But it's, like, two women of color in Canada just unpacking, like, history that's not, like, centered on whiteness.
Mm-hmm.
So they unpacked, like, an episode on, like, statues. They unpacked, like, Banff, the history of Banff. Because right now it's, like, super touristy, but before it was, like, not that. Yeah. It's like 20 minutes, bite size.
I'm gonna recommend Still Processing. I know I talked about Jenna Wortham at the beginning, but I love that podcast a lot because it's just like two people, and I don't know about what kind of podcasts you guys like to listen to, but I like podcasts where two people who I think are really cool and smart and like have really good takes just say what they think about certain things. And like, yeah. But I also want, I was like, a good representation. ContraPoints, I don't know.
Yeah.
I love her. Her videos are really, like, artistic and, like, very, like, theatrical. And I think that she's bringing, like, a different kind of, like, video essays as, like, a thing in YouTube
exactly.
right now.
What I like about ContraPoints or any sort of video essayist is that they're bringing these conversations that we have in an academic setting that are very much limited to just the academic setting to a broader, much more accessible platform in which everyone gets to be part of the conversation. Everyone that's watching gets to be part of the conversation because I think academia is so all about, like, restricting knowledge production within the bounds of itself and its own borders, and ContraPoints and other video essays really break that mold.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really good for social justice, I think.
Decolonization.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Democratize
knowledge. Exactly. Knowledge becomes democratized.
Okay, so the next question I have is a bit off topic from representation and stuff, but my question is more situated at UBC.
Mm-hmm.
So does UBC have a rape culture? And have things changed or improved in your opinion since you've spent time at UBC? Maybe for younger students can give like their takes on what they feel like now, and then maybe we can talk also about like our experience at SAS too.
I feel like for UBC is like a very progressive university. I feel like a lot of academic institutions are like, you know, left wing leaning, and like Alexa and I are in the Law and Society cap stream, so all of our classes right now are like very centered around issues about like talking about consent and like that kind of thing, but then at the same time we see this kind of like underlying culture specifically in like frat life around just kind of sketchy consent practices and like just this, I don't know if it's like a lack of education in those areas, I don't know, because we have people in our cap stream that are in frats that are like learning all this stuff and like participating in a class setting, but then outside of a class setting, not practicing that. So,
yeah, and like what I've noticed as well, just with, I guess, party culture in general, I guess at UBC, I'll be walking down like Main Mall and like I'll see people I know and they won't talk to me, but then at a party they're like, oh hey, and they come up to me and they like give me a hug, and it's just like I feel like at parties people kind of use that as like an excuse to kind of invade like boundaries that would be set otherwise in like other contexts. Again, like I feel like a lot of excuses are made at parties when it comes to like consent and stuff, because like people, especially alcohol, I feel like that's a big one. People will be like, oh, like, I was drunk, so that, like, gives me an excuse to do this. Or, like, I'm in, like, this environment where everyone's crowded in this small space, which gives me the right to, like, be super close to someone. But no, and it's just, like, super toxic. And I've just, like, noticed that with going to, like, quite a few parties the past, like, few months, like, frat parties specifically.
I think, like, there is like a gap between like knowing all these things about rape culture and sexualized violence and like consent and boundaries and actually like practicing it.
Yeah, I
like used to be in a sorority, and I think like there is that gap in like, okay, we know that this is what you're supposed to do, we have workshops around it, we have conversations around it, but I think like implementing actual practices, practicing like everyday consent and like culture of consent is not as like prioritized because of the like party culture and just like the overall culture of what we associate with Greek life. I think there's that like disconnect that people have in terms of like what feels good and what you should perform as part of the community.
And like accountability as well. I feel like that's like a super big thing. Like just I guess tying back into like what we were saying before about like people making excuses and trying to justify their behavior and just saying things like, oh, it's party culture, but like you're not taking any responsibility for like what you're doing.
Has it changed much like over the time that you guys have been here?
Well, I was gonna say that like, so because I was kind of get at that, I was gonna be like obviously rape culture still exists, like insofar as we live on unceded lands and these lands have been stolen, taken without consent, or and are still being occupied without consent. And with like, for example, things like the approval of the pipeline, these issues that are surrounding the lands in which UBC is situated in, we still live within a culture of consent. We don't live within a culture of consent. We live in a rape culture. And in so far as how things have changed, I guess Tintin, like you and I maybe can talk about this, but I remember 4 or 5 years ago, I guess now, where I was, when I was applying to UBC, and it was like at the height of the like the really infamous rape cases that were coming forward against UBC, and I remember you being in high school and being like, oh, like that doesn't sound very good. And then when I entered UBC, like going to like things like Frosh Week, which I can't believe I went to, as a young first year trying to make friends, I remember like being like, we don't call this Frosh Week, we now call it Startup, or we call it X, Y, and Z, because we can't call it Frosh Week anymore because of all the scandals that happened. And even then I was like, yeah, but like it's still Frosh Week, like you can call it whatever you want to call it, it's just like you're not addressing what is at stake. Even then, in my, like, you know, in my, I was not at all embedded within social justice discourse. I was like, well, I don't know if this is making any difference. And now, being in fourth year and kind of, like, looking at kind of the work that I do, seeing, like, working with Tintin, with the Greek community, and all of our lovely volunteers to, like, address that, like, I think things have gotten, a little bit, or there's more conversation around it, there's an eagerness to do better, and it's just unfortunate that it had to come out of scandals, because it came out of like the Greek life workshops came out of a scandal last April year, and so everything, it feels like it's just a reaction to like wanting to make your name not be affiliated with sexualized violence, which I don't know, maybe that's a good thing, and maybe we should practice compassion and be like, well, there's something being done, but we should also be critical, I guess. I don't know. What do you think, Tintin?
Yeah, I mean, like, I agree with what you're saying. I think a lot of the things that are, like, I remember when the Fifth Estate documentary was released, when basically it was, like, shedding a light on, like, a bunch of these, like, sexual assault cases that were being perpetrated by the same person, and UBC, like, got its act together and, like, did, you know, was like, okay, like, we're gonna release Policy 131, like, later this year, and, like, they did all this stuff.
Right.
To, like, change UBC's, like, institutional.
But that was because of the province, you know? The province made it, yeah, the province made a mandate that all post-secondary institutions had to have a standalone sexualized violence.
It still wasn't, like, proactive.
It wasn't, it was just, like, they had to anyway, sorry.
No, but completely. Yeah. It's, like, one of these things where it's, like, okay, well, if everything's in reaction to other, like, scandals or negative things that are happening, like, we're never, like, two steps ahead. We're never, like, you know, like, preventing things from happening. We're just trying to right wrongs in some way, and then sometimes the way that we're trying to right these wrongs aren't even, like, fully thought through. Mm-hmm. I kind of agree, like, it's better, but it's also, there's still, like, a lot that needs to be done.
Mm-hmm. And the bar was, like, abhorrently low before, so it's, like, anything really can be better, but.
Mm-hmm. I remember seeing, like, really early in this year, like, when we first came here, and I was just talking about, like, frat life with people, and I think I looked up on, like, Facebook or something, like, UBC Frats, just to see what was there, and one of the first things that I saw was, like, an apology issued, or, like, a response to, like, sexual assault problems, I guess, and I remember I read it, and, like, the main focus of it was saying that they were, like, committed now to providing, like, support for survivors, and, like, it was all about reactionary things, like, it was not at all about, like, teaching consent and, like, anything, like, actually addressing the issues that are happening. It was all just, like, we're gonna teach people how to be good allies for people that experience it, like, instead of being, like, how do we stop this from happening? So really interesting.
I think that's problematic, because I feel that a lot of people recognize the importance of consent, but they don't know how to practice it.
For sure.
Girls don't know how to say no. Anyone. That's so true. Nobody, like, it doesn't have to be just girls. It can be guys, too. People don't know how to say no, and they don't know, like, their boundaries. It's a great opportunity for, you know, people to be educated, and it makes me sad, because as a support worker, I have to, you know, people ask me things, and I'm like, you know, I wanna help you, but I wish that it wasn't me. I wish everyone could just be in solidarity and be educated and work together to help each other out. You know, it doesn't have to come to sexual violence. We should all, like, learn how to prevent people from committing those acts in the first place by using our voices and knowing the value of our voice, because it's powerful.
Totally. Yeah. I was just going to say, like, boundaries and setting boundaries is really difficult, especially if you're, like, gendered, and if you're racialized, and if, like, you're all of the things that are like at the margins, like, boundaries are difficult. Setting boundaries, saying no, and, like, enforcing them is really difficult. It just makes me think of, like, the healthy boundary workshop that, like, the SASC just, a lot of tips in there are, like, so useful. Like, when I facilitated it, people were like I've never seen so many people just, like, writing aggressively, because we're not taught how to, like, set boundaries and, like, how to, like, say no and how to react to someone enforcing boundaries. Like, that's, like, a huge thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I feel like I was talking about it. The reason how the workshop came to be was because I was having a lot of trouble setting boundaries myself, and I went to counseling. Everyone should go to therapy, also. Plug for therapy in general. And they, like, I was talking to my therapist about, like, boundaries and, like, how I can't even set them in, like, my real life, even with, like, friends and stuff. It's not just, like, sexual or, like, romantic or, like, whatever, with, like, work or school. It's, like, personal things. Like, even with your friends, like, not knowing how to set those boundaries. And then also this weird feeling where you're, like, almost offended if somebody sets a boundary with you and you, like, don't know how to, like, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
There's just so many ways that we don't feel comfortable with boundaries. And even as women, too, I feel like it's weirder, because I think a lot of women, especially racialized women, like, feel like they have to always be available and, like, need to always be, like, willing and able to do something just to, like, prove that they're worth something.
And the minute we say no, you're a bitch.
Yeah.
Like, oh, how dare you say that?
Yeah.
And, or, like, you're too angry all the time. Why are you so mad? I hate that one. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Like, no, like, you've got to listen to what I'm saying, because if I don't say it, you're violating me, and that's not okay.
Yeah.
So
we're gonna take a little bit of a break. And we'll be right back.
of your brain. Crazy pink as we all go insane. So here we are in the car, leaving traces of us down a boulevard. I wanna fall through the stars. Getting lost in the dark is my favorite part. Let's count the ways we could make this last forever. Sunny, money, keep it funky. Touch your top it, let it down.
Welcome back to SASC's International Women's Day program. We just finished a conversation on rape culture at UBC and sort of just cultures of consent in general. But now we want to move on to a topic that's a little bit more, I don't know, hopefully warm for folks to think about, but self-care. So the question is, what is your relationship with self-care like, and how can we engage in sustainable forms of self-care?
Sorry, do you mean sustainable like environmentally or sustainable like over time?
Both. Or okay. How do you interpret the question?
Okay.
Yeah. I can start. I've been thinking about like self-care a lot because this month has been ridiculous for me in terms of like work and like school and like personal life as well. I feel like I've always felt like I had a really good self-care like regime going on, but I think really it's about like setting boundaries like we've set before in terms of like personal boundaries and like things that I do is just like I have to go to bed by latest like 11:30 and usually like right now I've been working on a couple of like work projects and group projects that like sometimes require me to be like online and available past that time, and like it's been really important to have that for myself in terms of like I need to get like at least 7 hours of sleep just so I know that I can like function. A big part of like having that as a sustainable thing that I keep to is just reminding myself that if I'm not replenished and like if I can't take care of myself, then I can't show up for other people. And that's been something that I've been, like, trying to internalize a lot, but it's very difficult. As we've said before, like, as a woman of color, you're just expected to be available and show up for other people. But I think for me, like, sleep and rest is a thing that I make sure that I get every single day, whether that's, like, time to myself.
Yeah, I have, like, a pretty bad, not bad as in, like, a harmful relationship, but, like, bad as in, like, I don't have enough self-care implemented. I think that sometimes I rely too much on how much I, and this is a whole separate conversation to have about, like, nonprofit work or any sort of activist work, how much I rely on, how much, like, the extracurricular, like, work that I do, as well as my job at the SASC, like, fulfill me. And that's not really a sustainable way of self-care, because eventually it does get tiring. And that's, like, and then it's, like, and then what? But Miley brought up a really good point of sleep, because because I'm a commuter student, like, I have to go to bed after at a certain time. Otherwise, it's just, like, my next day is just completely ruined, and I have to already spend, like, 3 hours on a bus a day anyway. Yeah. So it's, like, I need to stick to it. But, yeah, it's hard. And I've been really resenting myself for not being able to take better care of myself and just getting so overwhelmingly stressed of, like, yeah, like, no one's doing this work and blah, 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 blah. And I always find that, like, like, again, going back to that conversation of being a woman of color, like, we're just, like, there to pick things up and, like, clean up after other people. And, like, white women can just take a day off and be like, I'm doing this for myself, which is great. That's not to say that, like, that's bad. Like, I want to encourage self-care, but at the same time, like, self-care, when it's so individualized, it, like, you sometimes, like, need community care. So it's not like, oh, okay, well, this one person that was relying on is taking time off for themselves, and now it's all dumped on me. Whereas we could practice community care and, like, divvy things up equally and, like, make sure, check in with each one another and, like, make sure that everyone's taking care of themselves.
Well, there's privilege in self-care, too, right? There's, like, so much power embedded in who can actually take care of themselves and take the time to not do that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was just gonna say, like, emotional burnout is so, like, such a thing.
I know.
And social justice work and, like, counseling work and support work that, like, it's not talked about as much.
Somebody once told me recently that solidarity is my spirituality. I really analyzed that deeply, and I was like, you know what, I can relate to that. Because we always say, oh, I gotta do this, I gotta do this, you know, I have this deadline. But we forget in the moment that we have all these people around us to help us. And I think that we refuse, maybe it's the culture that we're in where it's so individualized, where we put it all on ourselves. And if we ask for help, it's almost as if we're afraid to ask for help, because it almost damages our own self-worth, or you're not able to do it. But that's not the case. Like, you have such a, being in solidarity, you're shouldering up with people, and you're learning from other people, and you're, like, opening yourself up to so many different ways of understanding the world, and maybe they can help you, and that's okay. Like, it's okay. And it, you know, I agree with what you were saying, that self-care, you got to help yourself first before you help others. One way of doing that is maybe reaching out to others and being like, I can't do this right now, I need your help.
I feel like there's, like, such a thing of, like, women not ever wanting to impose themselves on others, and, like, always wanting to be on the, not receiving end, but, like, always taking in others' emotional labor and then, like, not wanting to put it on other people, that it's, like, so hard to ask for help, especially when it comes to, like, getting emotional support and stuff like that. And I think that's something that could be considered self-care, is, like, just reaching out to other people, and that's something that I want to learn how to do more.
I also agree with how there's so much privilege in self-care. Not everyone can go to Mexico or Hawaii or Cuba.
Or, like, have lush baths every day.
Right? Or go to Lush, because Lush is expensive,
Lush
too.
Is so expensive.
Like, you know, it's hard to, there's no definition for self-care. It's very much intersectional. And it depends on who you are as a person. If you're a student, if you're graduated, if you're a mother or father, if you're, you know, even on your, it depends on your sexuality sometimes. Like, it's very difficult to say, oh, this is self-care, so you need to, like, do this.
Yeah. And not everyone even has access to the self part of self-care because mm-hmm. they have to care for other people. Yeah. Because they're a caregiver, for a parent, for a friend, for a child, for, mm-hmm. you know, so it's like, how is, for example, a single mom supposed to care for themselves when they have a child to, like, look after? Mm-hmm. Or I looked a lot to, like, my mom as, like, a racialized immigrant woman who's, like, also full-time, like, working full-time. Mm-hmm. And supports me, who's, like, yeah, I'm grown up, but then I also have a younger brother and, like, looks after all these things. Like, where do we fit mm-hmm. in that? Yeah. Because you have responsibilities. You have mm-hmm. these relationships and ethics of care that are very implicated, and so you can't, like, necessarily take yourself out of that mm-hmm. to take time for yourself. That's something that my mom told me from a very young age, mm-hmm. from when I was a very young age. She's like, I don't even know how to have fun anymore. Like, I feel like every time I am having doing something for myself, there's always guilt, like, of, selfish. It's like, I'm doing this for, I should be doing X, or I haven't cooked yet, or the I need to vacuum, or, like, I'm at work, or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And so will suck, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
because
say, oh, like, self-care is important.
Oh, yeah.
But then they're like, okay, you have this to do, mm-hmm. you have this deadline.
Take care of yourself.
Yeah. But then school is so expensive, so you have to, you know, work. And so after school, you go to work, and after work, you have to study, mm-hmm. and then you have to volunteer, because if you don't volunteer, you have zero experience, mm-hmm. and then you won't get your internship, or get into grad school. Mm-hmm. So where is that line, and how do professors or people on campus that have power acknowledge that life is crazy and everyone has different needs, and mm-hmm. how do we support your self-care as well as make sure that you succeed as a student?
Yeah. I saw a really good tweet that was, like, how faculty can model self-care and, like, work-life boundaries to students, and bullet points that were just, like, actually, like, have Monday to Friday hours and, like, only reply to emails, like, in certain times so that you're actually modeling it to your mm-hmm. students. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, you know, we talk a lot about, like, oh, you need to have a work-life balance and take care of yourselves, but they're not usually, like, actually modeled and practiced. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Going back to, like, the idea of privilege, too, it's, like, self-care as a concept, I feel like, has been much, like, commodified over the past couple years, and it's just, like, become this, like, capitalist idea that's, like, I don't know, people posting on Instagram about it, like, being, like, self-care, and it's, like, about wine and things that you buy and Lush and, like, all of that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And it also just makes me think about, like, people in poverty in Vancouver, especially, and, like, that just don't even have access to, like, the hygiene aspect of like that we're talking about self-care and that kind of thing. So it's definitely not an accessible, like, idea.
I also feel like it's, like, important to recognize that, like, there are, like, other methods of self-care, and it, like, varies across, like, different, like, cultural groups and stuff, and, like, there's not, like, one, like, specific thing that's, like, universal and that works for everyone. Like, the, like, Western idea of, like, Lush bubble baths and, like, wine is, like you said, it's, like, not accessible to everyone. So, like, I think it's also important to, like, know that, like, other types of, like, self-care are not, like, they're not, like, inferior to, like, these, like, Western, like, ideas of self-care, and that, like, different things work for different people. And then Lily was saying, like, the commodification of, like, self-care, it's kind of, I guess, like, it just makes me wonder, like, who's benefiting from this and, like, who's actually, like, receiving, like, the self-care, and, like, it's just it's just, like, not accessible.
Especially when you think about, like, the reason why people do self-care is because of the capitalist idea of productivity. So, like, it's that cycle of like, you're escaping from capitalism by using capitalism, like, as a way to, like, do it. No, can't dismantle the master's house with its tools.
Totally. Like, it's a really good point.
Can I plug, like, an incredible, like, woman of color who's doing great work around, like, self-care? So Dora Kamau, Bless Your Heart, is, like, the the initiative that she founded in Vancouver that, like, specifically talks about, like, self-care in the context of, like, gender. And also she does a lot of, like, exclusive events just for women of color. So I went to one last year, and then she does, like, the melanin mixer every
once in a while.
I've always wanted to go to that.
Yeah, it's really awesome. And she, like, literally takes self-care from, like, a really white and, like, class perspective and, like, make it accessible and do it exclusively in the perspective of, like, a gendered lens and, like, a racialized lens, but not in a way that's, like, inaccessible for folks who aren't in social justice circles. So she, like, does really awesome work around, like, how you can
be compassionate to yourself, mm-hmm. especially when you're living in a world that's like mm-hmm. racialized and gendered. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So the next question, I think I'm going to skip because you kind of talked about it already. But this is our last question. So reflecting on our experiences at Sovereign Bodies, which is an event at SAM where we talked about decolonizing consent, and also the Women's March and the Dead Honeyside Women's March specifically mm-hmm. on Valentine's Day, how can we incorporate decolonization into self-care and our activism? And how what does it mean to decolonize self-care? Thoughts in... feelings?
Yeah, I think, well, okay, so I would say that to me it means like decentering capitalism and like buy to feel good. It also means like developing a community of care in which you owe, mm-hmm. not necessarily you owe, but like in a very like reciprocal relationships, you take care of one another. And that means, like, you check in and then you, like, get a feel for, like, using these, like, empathetic relationships, mm-hmm. you make sure that everyone in your life is, like, doing well, or at least you get them the support that they need. So decolonization doesn't just become, like, a fetishization of violence and how oppressive and alienating the world is, which it is. We can take care of ourselves by, like, focusing on love and, like, using love as, like, a... it's like a strategy of like, mm-hmm. of like taking care of ourselves. And because when a community, like, I don't know about you folks, so I can't speak for you, but for me, like why I said at the beginning, I rely too much on how much the work that I do fulfills me. And sometimes that's not good. Like it's, the work fulfills me because I have a community of love and people that take care of me. It exhausts me sometimes because work is work and work is alienating, mm-hmm. like read Karl Marx. But yeah. like some of the times it's like that is my self-care. It's like being with mm-hmm. that circle who knows me and takes care of me. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All about I'll
take. Yeah, all about my bell hooks.
Like, true. I feel that... whenever my cup is full, mm-hmm. instead of saying hi to people that I see every day, yeah. I'll be like, how are you doing?
Yeah.
Because I'm actually interested in yeah. how they're doing. Yeah. Like, mm-hmm. they could be like, oh, I'm not actually having a good day, then I can support them. Mm-hmm. But it just depends on how I'm feeling. So if I feel like I have mm-hmm. energy in me to, like, mm-hmm. sit down and have a conversation, and it's a genuine conversation of how, mm-hmm. you know, how are you doing? Mm-hmm. And I can actually spend the time to listen to them, then I will do that. Mm-hmm. That's my self-care.
Mm-hmm. I feel like the question of self-care and, like, because there was also an event that I think... Decolonizing self-care. Self-care. And I was just thinking about that for a long time because I was like, mm-hmm. wow, like, literally, like, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. And also, yeah. like, what does decolonization mean in a meaningful yeah. way on a situated especially at, like, a place like UBC, which yes. is, you know... fraught with a colonial history. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, the Great March was literally people coming to Musqueam being like, we need more land to, like, yeah. do school. And you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, 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 yeah.
So I guess I asked this question mostly because I don't really have an answer, mm-hmm. And I'm genuinely curious. But I guess in some way, like, it was reflected when I was at the Valentine's Day March. And you were there too, Miley, weren't you?
I was volunteering.
You were volunteering, okay. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, and you guys were there too. Oh, my God, wow. So we were there. but... like, being in that space and, like, feeling mm-hmm. energized by all these people mm-hmm. who, like, want to get together and, like, make, you know, show up for their fellow human mm-hmm. Is a form of self-care, too. Yeah. Like, participating yeah. in activism mm-hmm. can also be mm-hmm. a form of self-care, weirdly enough.
Yeah.
But we have to, like, strike that very perfect balance, which, again, is hard, especially if your work mm-hmm. your work is based around activism and mm-hmm. based around, like, anti-violence work. Mm-hmm. And nonprofit work. So yeah. I don't know, yeah. It's very tricky.
Mm-hmm. I went to a Wet'suwet'en protest and I saw a kid that I work with outside of UBC and he was there and he was so excited to see me and that brought a lot of joy to me because it showed to him that I'm not just a I don't just talk about like justice. I actually show up to these yeah. events and to see someone familiar in mm-hmm. that space. And to tell them that I'm here for you, mm-hmm. like I'm with you. It was really empowering, and mm-hmm. it felt so good.
Mm-hmm. yeah. Solidarity is such like a good feeling when, yes, you know it's like meaningful, mm-hmm, solidarity and people are showing up like with you instead of,
it's so moving.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. When it's like not performative, you're just like, maybe the world is a good place.
Mm-hmm. Well, mm-hmm. I think we are out of time for the studio. Oh, sorry. Oh, yeah, do you want to, you'll go off.
Okay, yes. I guess our final words is that the SASC, okay, so the MS elections are ongoing, for those of you that are part of the UBC community or know of, like, MS politics. And from March 11th to 15th is voting day. And on the ballot this year is a referendum that proposes to increase the SASC's fee by $5.67 up to $9.30. And if you have questions, we're going to be boothing for 3 weeks, so you can find us in the Nest, yeah, from 11 to 3 p.m. on most weekdays.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or you can drop by the SASC at any, yeah, time and ask, yeah, us questions.
Or write us an email. We're here for your questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah, thank you everybody for listening, and thank you to Nikki, Miley, Alexa, Lily, and Nav for being here today and indulging me on my radio dreams, my radio dreams.
Thank you, Tintin.
Yeah. Thank you, Tintin, for organizing this, writing the questions.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you for inviting us all to this space.
Yes, wow. Absolutely.
This is community care.
This is community care.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Bye.